Welcome to Series 3 of My Life in Design, brought to you by the DBA and design-focused PR agency Red Setter. I'm Claire Blythe, co-founder of Red Setter, and this series I'm speaking to 10 more people shaping the world of design to find out what first inspired them and how they got to where they are today. This week on My Life in Design, I'm here with Harry Pierce of Pentagram. Harry co-founded his own design firm, Lipper Pierce, which he ran with Dominic Lipper and Giles Calver for 16 years before becoming a partner at Pentagram. Pentagram's a multidisciplinary design agency made up of 24 equal partners that was created 50 years ago, just over 50 years ago, in 1972. And he's worked around the world devising identities, installations, posters, packaging, books and talks as diverse as Guggenheim, Liberty, Thames and Hudson, CAMS Arts Centre, human rights charity Witness, John Lewis and Waitrose, Royal Academy of Arts. We've got Berry Brothers and Rudd, Fiden Press, Pink Floyd Records, Penn International, Science Museum and the UN. He's also created identities for Anish Kapoor and Ai Weiwei for when they had their major retrospectives at the Royal Academy. His work's been exhibited in New York, Paris, London, Toronto and Naples. Since 1993, he's been an active member of the advisory board for Witness, a human rights charity founded by Peter Gabriel. He's also a committed member of the Alliance Graphique International, spoken at design conferences around the globe, from Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, the US, India, Holland and Costa Rica. Harry, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on. Should we get stuck right in and talk about...
Please. Yeah, absolute pleasure. No, I'd love to.
When you were a child, was there a moment when you realised design was a thing you could base a career around? Was it more arts-based? What was those early sort of sparks of thought?
I grew up in a tiny village in the West Country.
Yeah.
Down near, between Stroud and Cirencester. And
yeah, okay.
I had a lovely upbringing. My mother was deeply into music and art and literature. My father was an English teacher and an academic, and sort of the house was full of art and creativity or whatever. And I drew a lot. I wasn't a tall academic at school. School was a struggle. I was deeply dyslexic. So my art lessons were a real refuge. You know, I loved art, and despite my dyslexia, I loved English as well. And
did you realise you were dyslexic at the time?
No one ever said. And
wow,
I just knew it was deeply painful, embarrassing having to stand up and read in class when I failed. And the place would fall about laughing, and it was very difficult. But no one ever said, you just carried on struggling through, people carry on dragging you out to embarrass yourself. And the worst thing was I couldn't read names. And I remember we were reading the book, The Wooden Horse or something. Every time a name came up of a character in the book, I just froze. And the trouble is, everyone could see it coming, and it would just be worse every time it happened. So I had a terrible time.
It's a build-up. It becomes a real trauma, awful. Doesn't it, in your mind, that sort of stuff. Yeah.
And both my sons are dyslexic, but they've overcome it amazingly.
Brilliant.
But I knew what it was when they... You know, we all knew.
Yeah.
So we were able to get them help and whatever. But such as it was. But it gave me something else, you know. It's ironic that my life is so deeply embedded in language and words and logos and whatever. But I think through working with that stuff and seeing, I see words as images a lot of the time. So it was a gift that I didn't recognize.
Yeah.
It really was. And
that's interesting. I was just reading in your retrospective book, actually, about what you mentioned about the Fife's banana logo.
Yeah.
You didn't see it as
I couldn't read it. It made no sense as a word to me.
Yeah.
Fife's, Fife's, folks, I couldn't. But as a mark, as a thing, it remained forever. So, I think that was a moment of recognition, actually.
Yeah.
But I have to say, my art teacher, Danny Drinkwater, who I dedicated my book Eating with the Eyes to, was amazing. And, you know, and he was constantly positive about the possibilities of, you know, a life in art for me, actually. And my parents would come home exasperated from kind of parents' teachers' evenings.
Yeah.
But he would just go on saying, it's fine, he's going to be fine. And they were saying, but he's like struggling here, he's struggling there. And anyway, he had faith, and eventually I...
That's fantastic.
You know, and I was drawing all the time at home. I must just, I'm coming on 63 now, and I was looking, I've moved house recently, and I found all my old sketchbooks from way back in my childhood.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I've kept them all. And it's, I can see I was just spending weekends sketching.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, so I did a foundation course at his suggestion.
Wow, what an enlightened teacher to realize that actually can take you into a career or way of life.
Yeah, he had complete faith. And on that course, as you know, you try many different things in that year, don't you?
Yeah.
And about halfway through, I thought I was going to be more of an artist than a designer. And about halfway through that year, in one of those evening classes where we were drawing a, you know, eggs floating in water in a plastic bag in midair and all that crazy stuff. And I remember the guy teaching us just saying that he'd been watching me over the last 6-8 months, whatever it was, and he was just saying, the way you go about things is the nature of the ideas that you make are much more akin to design than they are to fine art. And he said, concentrate for the last 3 or 4 months on that.
Yeah.
And then you'll have some kind of portfolio to go to college with. And I took him at his word, and I, you know, because you do, right? And
yeah.
You did it. And what it sort of did for me, and it undoubtedly pushed me in the right direction, because I've just had the most wonderful life from this,
being a designer. Well, yeah, I can see
it's wonderful. And so I'm you know, grateful for that, but it also kind of shut this door on the freer side of my work, you know, and I thought, well, I'm not allowed, you know, I didn't have permission to be the artist that I thought I should be. However, it's taken me a long time,
literally.
But I've got past that now, and actually for a long time, art's been a huge part of what I do as part of my work, though that may not be obvious, you know, in the end results to folk, but it absolutely is. So
did it take you a while to get back into creating art again?
Then? I started painting enormous oil canvases in the 90s, and I have done ever, you know, carried on. However, it was in those 6 months where I switched and started to realize that, you know, design was probably the route I was going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the same kind of era where I was madly in love with LP covers and book covers you know, you sort of think, you can make stuff like this and you can make a life out of it. So that became more... just more of a reality during the last of the foundation. Then when I got onto my degree course at Canterbury, I had some wonderful tutors there that just were the thing, you know, or they were the thing that they just convinced me of the possibilities of this. And one guy was an illustrator called Ian Beck, who did Radio Times covers. And he came down one day a week to Canterbury, and Andre Klimowski, who was doing beautiful things, a lot of book covers at the time, and a guy called John Warwicker, who was one of the founders of Tomato.
Absolutely.
So those three.
I interviewed Graham Wood in the first series of this.
So,
also Tomato.
Those three were sort of, from such, you know, diverse work that they were doing. They were the ones that really opened my eyes properly.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, and I used to come up to London sometimes and see Ian or Andre and go to events and shows with them while I was at college, and I sort of became, got my insights into the design world.
How did you get into Canterbury? Was it? Did you apply for a few? And
I did the same. You know, we did. Yeah, I did. I think I applied for Manchester, Canterbury, and I can't remember. It was one other. But Canterbury, I felt very at home at Canterbury. What was nice was the other side of England from home, so I felt like I was going on an adventure.
Yeah, definitely.
And I loved the place, and I had a very, very happy 3 years there, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Mm.
Is it a good design school?
Yeah, it's excellent. It's excellent.
Yeah.
And from there, I literally, at the end of the 3 years, I put a portfolio together. They were letting... Imperial College were sort of letting student rooms out for the summer holidays really cheap.
Oh, wow. That's
so I got one of those for a month, 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And I would literally go through the phone book, make lists of agency names, studio names, and just get on the phone, get into a little red phone box and ring.
Wow, really?
Every day and hustle every day till someone would see me, and I just walked the streets with my portfolio knocking on doors. And then eventually...
I love that determination.
Yeah, you just have to keep...
Getting there.
And I was just, you know, little country boy hustling on the London streets for a break.
Yeah.
And that was that. I just kept going until I walked into this very small, I got an interview with a small agency called Michael Theron's Design.
Uh-huh.
And someone literally had left the week before. And I was lucky there was a gap. And I got my break. Yeah.
So brilliant.
It's just simple as that, really.
That's it. Only takes one thing, doesn't it? And then you're in and it's easier. Yeah. Easier to move around and move up at that point. So how long were you there for? What's the...
I can remember it being quite a frightening place. You know, you do it because there was only three or four of us, five of us in the studio.
Yeah.
And you'd have to do everything. And I remember it took me years to get over the kind of fear of doing things, you know, setting all the setting right and getting into that.
Did you get over it? Just through practice and doing it?
Yeah, no, I used to go in bloody early. I used to go in at like 6:30 in the morning and put the hours in before everyone else because I just didn't want to make mistakes. I wanted to get it right. And I did that forever, actually. And eventually, I overcame it. And you could, instead of the mechanical act of doing what you had to do to design and make things, the fear receded and the ability to have ideas and make things just got stronger and stronger, and I got happier and more relaxed. I think I was there for 5 years.
Yeah.
And then, and Dominic Lipper came and worked there, and that's where we met.
Great.
And we've kind of been partners for 36, 7 years since.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you guys both joined Pentagram together.
And at that same time, I remember coming to Pentagram with Michael Theron's to present to John McConnell, work for We're on the Boots roster at the time. And that's the first time I began to present anything to anyone.
Yeah.
And it's when I met John McConnell. So he was very encouraging, supportive. And then, I still had Ian and Andre as sort of support and friends. And then I met Alan Fletcher.
Yeah.
He became a mentor and a friend,
amazing,
along with John McConnell. So that's where my life started to kind of get a little traction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So is that when starting to present, starting to meet people? And do you like presenting?
I love it. I love it. I think if you've had time to do it well, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, it just reminded me, thinking back to those days of walking with a portfolio, I actually wrote to Pentagram, and I have got somewhere which I should dig out. I've got a rejection letter.
Have you?
Yeah. So that should have gone in the new Pentagram book, actually.
Definitely.
Should have dug that out, shouldn't I? I have. It's very funny.
Yeah. But that just goes to show, doesn't it? Just because you get refused from somewhere once, keep on going with the whole thing.
Mm.
So what made you decide to want to start up on your own? So that was with Dominic and Giles.
I think we learned a lot from Michael. Michael's a very passionate, dedicated, tiny design company, but with really high standards.
Who are you working for there?
We were doing Boots work. We were doing Boots. We were working with Porsche. We were working on Love Waitrose, actually.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, we actually did a range of quite a lot of packaging with Waitrose.
Uh-huh.
We were working with Humber, who were an interior furniture company. Mm. It was a real spread.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I learned there is jumping between very different kind of design disciplines, from identity to packaging to print to, poster work to books. And so I've been determined all my career never to get cornered. Didn't want to ever do any one type of thing, and I did start to get cornered, and I've made sure that's not remained, because I just, there are so many wonderful, you spread yourself out and you can learn so much and you can feed off so much if you just stay fresh by doing, jumping into very different things. I went to Newland Sorrell, Dom followed on a year or so later.
Yes.
And it was a very different experience because it was a much bigger agency.
Yeah, they were one of the largest brand agencies.
Yeah, they were running
amazingly
professionally run and doing an extraordinary scale of work that I'd never been near before.
Yeah.
So learned a huge amount there. And then I guess Dom and I just thought, well, if we kind of all that experience, if we weld it together.
Yeah.
And I think we felt very driven to do our own thing for a very long time. And I think having him.
Yeah.
And the conversations, having that possibility of a partnership, and then realizing we needed someone who would help manage be strategic, and who someone else who was actually a brilliant writer and as well, yeah. which was Giles. So we that's how that came about. We kind of thought we needed, we definitely know we needed that more of a business side to the business than just us doing design work. Yeah, so that's what we did. And we waited for my second child to be born. And if he came out okay and healthy, we all literally within a week or two, as soon as he was arrived, we all handed our notices in.
Wow.
And we had nothing. We had one client for, I think we had about, was it a £600 budget for a little project for a cheese company in North London?
Wow, so tiny little.
Nothing.
That's
we had nothing.
Yeah.
And then we just had to go out and hustle.
So how did you get some clients? What did you do?
We kind of made things. We made things that helped build a portfolio because we couldn't take the work from the agencies. You know, back in those days, you didn't.
Yeah.
Not like now. I mean, look online now and everyone's just putting up the work from the agencies they've just been working at, and you couldn't do that back then.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So you just had
you'd
to
get into
go
a lot
out
of trouble.
And, you know, make stuff. So we just any chance to make a poster, to do a little bit of packet, anything. And then after about 6 months, we got a call from Boots, and John McConnell had put us on the Boots roster.
Brilliant.
So we got our first bit of packaging then, and then it just went from there. You know,
we
started with very little. We had enough money to last for 6 months for the rent, the photocopier, telephones. We'd all raised enough. People sold things, stuck some money on the mortgage.
Yeah.
We just had enough for 6 months, and we got by for 6 months. And at the end of the first year, I think we made a £40,000 profit or something like that.
Wow.
We couldn't believe it. And
that's
were taking
really
almost
good.
No money. I mean, we were just taking, you know, just like enough to pay our own mortgages and
just the bare minimum
bare
to
minimum.
Get out of it.
Yeah.
But at least you made a profit.
We did. We couldn't believe it. We did make a profit. And then it just kept going and growing for 16 years. I mean, we were at our height when we joined Pentagram. We didn't join because it was failing. We just wanted to, we thought about having more partners ourselves.
Yeah.
And then in the end kind of thought, well, you know, when this offer came, you just thought, why not just join the real deal? You know,
yeah.
And the way we worked was, and I was so close to John Mack and so close to Alan, who'd left Pentagram by then, but I was spending a lot of time with Alan, and he obviously was really encouraging, and the fit was great. You know, we just moved. At the time, I think we were about 14. We just moved 14 people in here.
Wow!
So it was quite a change for Pentagram, and it was a big change for us.
That's so. It's still the same studio we're in now. That's the
in
and
here.
You just moved. Wow!
Yeah,
okay.
We just packed up. We just paid off our rent.
Yeah.
And closed the studio and just literally moved in here over a weekend. Yeah.
Definitely. Had you always been, I mean, Pentagram's such an amazing institution, isn't it? Such a different way of running a design agency.
Yeah, yeah. I'd actually been asked by Pentagram to join a lot earlier.
Really?
Back in the early 90s.
Are you glad you didn't?
I said no,
a way
actually.
That, yeah, did you?
I felt too green. I didn't feel ready. So I at that point I said no, but we were really ready when we, you know, and coming with Dom, I felt there was, you know, we've always supported each other through thick and thin. So I think that made the transition a lot easier.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So could you tell me a little bit about Pentagram today and that sort of side? Then
yeah,
I'd love to know more about your work.
Pentagram was an ideal. I came here because I believed in the idea of what Pentagram is.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it started 50 years ago. It's called Pentagram because five folk started it.
Yeah.
Three graphic designers, a product designer, and an architect.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that they formed was this notion that they would share everything financially, that that they would learn from each other and collaborate with each other. And that the idea is that, you know, it's rare in a design career that you're just in the sort of upward trajectory the whole time. It's up and down, up and down.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you had a few of you, that up and down gets evened out, you know.
Yeah.
And if you're sharing income, you can help each other survive.
Yeah.
And that was the premise. And it's now, I mean, it's 24, 25 of us now, and it flexes and changes. And the idea, the beautiful idea is that it'll never be sold. that there is no MD, there's no chief exec.
I didn't realize this is absolutely flat. Yeah, really interesting.
We meet every 6 months, somewhere in the world for three days or so, and we discuss who's going to be the next partner, and that's our business plan. And that's the sole driving thing.
So one person leads it every 2 years?
Yeah.
And then you discuss who's going to be the next.
For my sins, I'm called chairman, and for my sins, I'm the chairman, and I'm in the middle of, I've just done two of them, and I've got two left to do. So you chair it, you organize it. Everyone has different responsibilities that rotate around the business. Yeah, it's amazing. And you're all equal. There's no real voting. We debate everything till there's just a general agreement.
Yeah.
And any one person can stop anything. One person can stop another partner joining or whatever.
Does that make it difficult to do things?
It means we make long, slow decisions about things. Yeah. So we are not as nimble as a... Look, 50 years and we're still, you know... one thing that's really important is that the current generation hand the business down to the generation behind them.
For nothing. I love that idea. I think that's quite amazing. It's really unusual.
And what it does mean that the people, whoever's coming in now are sort of current to their time. So it isn't just these old folk who are still trying to hang on. It's actually the next energy that comes behind them keeps Pentagram relevant to its age.
I think why Pentagram's still so important.
Yeah, I think so.
By saying it's 50 years old, it can sound like it's a bit old-fashioned, but it's not. I mean,
no, it's quite the opposite.
It's forever changing.
It's forever changing, and that is not easy, and it's uncomfortable sometimes, and it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
And you have to be constantly generous. You know, if you make money and others don't, you give up your money to the others, and vice versa. And the idea is that you're having good days and bad days, or good years and bad years, and there's other folk that are doing the same at a different rhythm to you.
Yeah,
and you all kind of help each other stay, you know, reasonably strong.
Yeah.
So, we're never going to be millionaires, but we're free.
Yeah.
And we work on a lot for nothing and a lot for good money. And somewhere between all of that, you can have a really rich, generous career in that, I think.
Massively, yeah. I mean, just going through your introduction here, the people you've worked for. Can we talk about some of the work? Can I ask about Witness and how you got involved in that?
Well, that goes right back to my childhood. So... growing up in my village in the West Country, I would hear and witness things like fox hunts, which are appalling.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I remember the fox hunt actually crashing through my garden once and down through the woods behind where I lived. It was fucking terrible.
I've never actually seen it. Well, it's horrific.
I've never seen the kill or anything, but... The idea of that for sport is just so...
Oh, yeah, it's awful.
And one of the worst things they do is, the night before the hunt will go around and block the foxhole. So even if the fox outruns them, they've got nowhere to go. Yeah. So one of my first forms of protest as a teenager was going around and finding these... with friends going around and finding these foxholes and digging them out again.
Yeah.
So that they could get back in.
Brilliant. I love that. Yeah. Oh, it makes me feel sick that they actually
did that. And when I got to college, I was deeply into animal welfare and I tried to do things to support the International Fund for Animal Welfare. There was one point during my time at Canterbury, I rang up my parents and said, look, because I had got something like 50% of my the money to pay for my course. I got like a 50%.
Oh, like student grants and that
yeah,
kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, yeah,
so
my grant.
Yeah, yeah.
And I rang my parents and saying, I just can't take this anymore. I want to give all my money to animal welfare and I'll come and get another, And my parents were brilliant. They just said, you're nuts. Why don't you stick at what you're doing? Because one day maybe you can turn that into something that can really help instead of just giving what would amount to a very small amount of money.
You got very sensible parents.
Yeah, they were brilliant.
Definitely.
The penny kind of dropped. I thought, you're right. So I started,
affect things massively
When we started up Lipper Pierce, I was still really driven by all of this and we did a lot of charitable work. And the idea with Lipper Pierce was we said it's going to be like Robin Hood.
Mm.
The money we make will help, with fee-paying clients, we'll steal time to... payback by doing free work for a lot of charitable work. And we did a lot for many different ones. And then the changing point for me when I got involved with Witness, I got a call from this lady in The Hague And she said, because years before that, I'd met Peter Gabriel, and I'd been very moved by this song called Biko by Peter Gabriel, which is...
Okay. I'll have to check that out. I don't
it's,
know about
Oh, it's
particular.
Amazing. It's
Peter Gabriel's amazing, but
yeah.
I don't know.
Well,
yeah.
It's a song he wrote for Steve Biko, who was murdered by the South African police in Port Elizabeth. And it's a very moving song. And it resonated with me hugely. Anyway, in the meantime, I'd met him. And when we set up Lippa Pierce, he invited me down to lunch at his studios, and I showed him what we were going to do with Lippa Pierce, and we've just kind of got friendly. Anyway, there's this lady who rang me from The Hague, Camille Massey, and she said she'd been talking to Peter Gabriel, and she was coming back to London, and could she meet me to talk about doing an identity for the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights in New York?
Brilliant.
And she turned up, and she said, the reason I'm talking to you is because Peter's created this thing called Witness, and it's going to be part of the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights.
Uh-huh.
And he's had this idea of using Sony Handycam had just come out.
Oh, wow.
And so... he'd been touring with Amnesty International, and he'd filmed lots of conversations with people who had been, whose villages had been through genocide, whose families had been, you know, wiped out, and the truth of what's actually happened had been buried. But these conversations he had on film.
So it was set up. So I was researching a bit about Witness and what it was, and I assumed the concentration on video, which is really clever. Obviously, you used to do that. Was since iPhones and that.
No.
That's interesting. So it started
iPhones.
With that.
So what he did was set this thing up, and the idea was a little brother watching Big Brother, turning the cameras around the other way.
Yeah.
And then there was the Rodney King beating, and that's what triggered it. And he got a seed fund from Reebok of $1 million, I think, to set this thing up. He started shipping out cameras to oppressed people around the world and helping. Then they started helping train them to film things properly so that then they could link with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights and bring it as real evidence. So it's not just archival, it became real evidence. And that went on for a very long time. And Camille told me about it, and she showed me a film that so moved me. So I wrote to Peter and said, look, they already had an identity then, which was done by Chiat Day, which was great, actually. It wasn't a bad identity at all. And I had this idea that we were doing many different charitable things at Lippa Pierce, but I thought if we just concentrate on one, we could probably have a greater effect rather than little bits for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so I wrote to Peter and said, look, you guys are making the films, but how do you get people to watch these films? What's the story that people to think, I need to see this film?
Hmm.
How about I start creating some kind of graphic storytelling around these films to get them greater traction?
Interesting.
So we started doing campaigns with them.
And then where did you get them? Oh, so you got them out into the media?
We got them out into the media and out into, you know, so for instance, they were making a film about atrocities of the military junta burning in the villages in Burma. And I created a poster for that and a campaign that went with it. And Witness kind of existed because they had so many connections with pressure groups all around the planet. Mm. And they would send out some of this material to, you know, if there was an event or something, it would help support the event anywhere in the world. And I remember turning on someone said to me, turn on the news tonight. And I saw this BBC footage of people marching in the streets in New York, in Burma, in various other places of the world, hundreds of people carrying our posters down the streets. You know, and
that's
it was,
fantastic.
And it was then,
yeah,
yeah, and it suddenly realized, oh, this works. It's like,
yeah.
So I've just stayed doing that with them for the last 27 years. And now, obviously, what changed everything was the mobile phone.
Yes, of course.
So we can all witness, and you only have to see some of the things that, you know, people now are covering. And now it's more about what's false and what's true. So,
yeah, well, that's definitely where it's all.
Yeah. So Witness is still doing the same thing, but they are doing a lot more about facilitating and protecting people that are witnesses.
Yeah.
Helping them get films out, you know, and helping bring them to court, helping validate things.
Mm.
And there are many sides to Witness, but it's a phenomenal thing. It's a phenomenal thing. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, so when I joined Pentagram, I promised Witness I'd carry on. And I promised Pentagram that, you know, if I didn't stay in profit, then I'd obviously have to give it up. And sometimes we're very busy with it, and sometimes it's, you know, we're about to start a project with them shortly. We've been working on this sort of global sort of framework for multiple groups to drop all their stories into Witness film and storytelling. So it's a little quiet thing that's going on. Yeah, as I say, sometimes we're very busy with it and sometimes just ticking over and you just help wherever you can.
Was that the one client then that you've just taken with you?
Yeah. It's been with me for, 27 years, I think.
Brilliant. That's game-changing stuff.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the, I mean, if young folk listen to this, realizing that you can have a creative life and a career, and it's a profound privilege, you know, to spend your days being creative, making money out of it, and, you know, feeding into your culture. And you have a choice whether you make that a pure kind of commercial thing or whether you, it's a very powerful thing that you're involved in, whether you realize it or not. And you can turn parts of it to do many things. And for me, human rights has been a big part of it, and animal welfare too.
Of course.
And I just see it's a balance. It's a balancing the privilege that you have in some way, you know?
Yeah,
you,
absolutely. Well, that's, you can see from the list of people that you work with. I love the fact that you do, like, work with the UN, but also work with good retailers like John Lewis and Waitrose and that side of things as well. Just keep things really fresh.
Yeah. It's important. And it's important to be close to the, you know, some of the stuff I have to see in terms of film with witnesses is just so graphic and disturbing. You know, it's, it really, if I remember some, we were working with someone who we were doing all the packaging and the campaign around her film. And she was shot through the head within days of us working with her.
Oh my God.
So you might be sitting in a desk in London working on something, but you know, that person who's on the front line in Chechnya, and this was, and the Russians just took her over the border and shot her in the face.
Oh my gosh.
Mm. And that was an incredible shot.
Yeah, you're really connected with that. Yeah. That's just horrific.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah.
So I think it's that reality. Mm. And you're still divorced from the real reality, but to feel that close to stuff, that it gives you a perspective and a respect for things, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
Yeah, God, that's the shocking side of not doing the more commercial stuff, really, isn't it? Mm. But really, really, yeah, hugely worthwhile.
Yeah.
Can I ask you more about your sort of creativity day in, day out, and how you, do you fuel that? Is that mainly through your own art? Do you have other ways of...
Well, I think the more I've been living this career, I think you realize that you're just surrounded by influence constantly, you know.
Yes.
And if you keep your eyes wide enough and your senses open and interested, you're being fed all the time.
You know,
you walk down the street, jumping on the tube, kind of a flight somewhere, or any, I mean, I mean, You're just surrounded.
Happens.
You just need to be kind of observing, keeping notes, and just swallowing it up, because it all comes. It's all the answers for everything you need are around you, frankly.
Yeah, and, I think you're right. You don't have to go. I've heard that so often that you don't have to be. You have to go to an exhibition in an art gallery. Although I love doing that.
Yeah.
It could just be noticing how I don't know, something's fallen on a wall or.
Yeah, I made a little book a few years ago called Eating with the Eyes, and it's literally full of photography that I've taken. Since, well, actually, mainly from the 10 years prior, the ones I put in the book, but I've been photographing sort of stuff.
Yeah, you know, I've seen some on your Instagram. It's really cool stuff.
It's just stuff. And it, and
I'd love to see the
you
book.
I'll dig one out when we're
That'd
done.
Be fantastic.
But you can
you.
Look at things. So there's one photograph in the book, which is nothing more than a shot I took in Naples of a chain that's with a little hook on it that's been hanging on a wall for hundreds of years probably. But the chain had left this mark on the wall where it's been swinging from all the years of use. And it's like and it's just a chain with a mark on the wall.
Yeah.
But actually it's a memoir of the whole life of that chain.
Yeah.
So you can look at things and go, oh, it's just a chain. Or you can see there's a story there for you. And
the movement's been etched into
the
wall.
And you can find stuff like that everywhere and anywhere. And once you start looking, it appears. It really appears. And it's beautiful stuff. So I use those photographs in my work, but it's not just literally taking the picture. It's using the idea of it makes your mind jump into another kind of thinking.
Yeah, definitely. I always think that kind of way of living your life must improve your mental health, of just being able to spot the beauty in things around you all the time.
Exactly.
That's the, I think it would, just for me.
Easy and free as well.
Definitely. Can I ask you about the design industry? What are your thoughts on the design industry, and do you feel part of it, and what do you find challenging about it?
I think to be a real driven, living, passionate design company, yeah, it has to be owned by and run by entirely the people who make the work. That's a real, yes, design company for me, because all the decisions then get made about the work.
Yeah.
You know, and that's your raison d'etre, and that's what you're doing it for.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's what attracted me to Pentagram, is that that's held in, you know, that's like a torch that will never be dropped.
I love that.
So when I see this sort of sheer scale and expanse of agencies, you know, being bought up and swallowed and whatever, I find that not easy. You know, that's, yeah, it's kind of the scale of that. I don't know.
Are they truly going to get the best work?
If you want some control, you've got to keep it small, you know?
Yeah.
And Pentagram looks big. It's an entire illusion, because we are small teams.
Yeah.
Which run entirely how we like within this group. We gather together to look big.
Yeah.
But we're actually, so that method of staying really intimate and close with the work and not having great sort of pyramids of management between you and the work and the business.
Yeah.
That's the bit in the industry that I find uncomfortable and difficult. And,
yes,
and I've stayed away from.
Yeah.
I think the thing I find most difficult is actually just time and space to do everything that needs to be done. There's just such a,
yeah,
I'm just so crazily, insanely busy all the time that's
yeah, that's, maybe the acceptance that you can't do everything and still be happy.
I'm happy. Yeah. I'm happy, but tired.
Yeah.
But I'm very happy.
that sounds good.
But it's, and I guess you orientate to the people you know, you kind of have empathy with, don't you? And so there's this, you know, being in AGI is fantastic. There's amazing people there. So, you know, we meet up once every year. I can't keep up with all of them, but or even keep up with all the meetings. But so AGI, Alliance Graphique International, it's 300 or so designers from around the world who get invited to be a part of it. And then you, through your portfolio, and then you you kind of just meet up and share for 3 or 4 days a year.
Yeah.
That's
brilliant.
It's nothing to do with Pentagram. It's entirely separate thing. It started in the 1930s in Paris by people like Cassandra and people like that, who wanted this sort of fraternity of folk to help defend the rights and quality of design.
Right, okay.
Back in the 1920s, 30s in Paris.
Wow.
It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, that is an amazing thing.
Yeah. So that was...
Where did you last get together?
When?
Where?
Where? Somewhere. So each country hosts all the other countries once a year. So next year, this year, it's in New Zealand.
Ah, fantastic.
And the last one, I think, was in Trieste in Italy. So, you know, you go and they host it, and then you know, we all put a bit of money in the pot and go along and hang out.
That's
and
really
it's good.
Cool,
and you learn. My God, you learn from extraordinary people around you. You know,
everyone, I can imagine.
Everyone presents to each other. And so there are parallels between Pentagram, I guess, because when the partners go away for our few days every 6 months, every night for 3 nights, 3 partners present.
Oh, okay.
So you have to every year you have to do a talk for the other partners
about what you've been up to and what you're doing.
Yeah. So all of that knowledge we all learn from each other, and then 9 other people do it the next 6 months later.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So you're constantly sharing and gaining.
Yeah,
that's really great.
Yeah.
So can I ask you, can I ask you about juniors starting out today?
Mm.
What top tips have you got? What kind of tips would you give people of how to get into the industry and how to survive and be noticed?
Yeah. I think it has to be a real commitment. I think you have to feel like you're doing this as a way of life.
Yeah.
And I think if people can feel that in you, that you are committed that way, then I think you stand a great chance to be in a joining a really, really great studio or team or whatever. Or even if you go out on your own, I think if you're going out on your own, you know it's a way of life, right?
Yeah.
And there's a complete commitment to that. And I think, you know, I know when I look through portfolios, and I have to say it's really hard to differentiate between a lot of portfolios today, because people present in such a similar way, you know, with that, through Instagram and everything, it's kind of so become so sort of homogenized, and
everything looks perfectly credible but the same.
Yeah, so down similar. And the people that stand out are people that put in very personal stuff that doesn't necessarily conform to that, you know. People that can break through that sort of relentlessness is really, it's, you know, find your own voice as best you can. And I know when early in your career it's hard to understand, even if you have a voice, and I didn't find mine till a lot later, but I think having very personal things in there that people can understand and read you from is really and then I think knowing the person that you're talking to, you know, we're inundated here, and people rock up and
of course
you feel they barely even know who they're talking to, and you think,
really?
Yeah.
God, just like, do your research. And
You know, kind of honour the person you're, you know, I mean, that doesn't happen much, but it's a couple of folk who come along and...
Yeah.
But I remember a guy who came along a few, just before COVID, actually, and he just came along with a really battered suitcase and bits and bobs of stuff and ideas that he'd made out of bits of, like, burnt wood and sketches and stuff. And his mind was so brilliant.
Yes.
So brilliant. And we... You know, and he just didn't conform.
That's
to the
great.
We took him on in a blink of an eye.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So almost seeing, I don't, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but seeing that, putting your portfolio together as your first branding job, you need to stand out and know who your audience are. And
And speak your mind.
You look the same as everyone else.
Speak your mind.
Just show your passion.
I think also, you know, I would say it's worth doing, and this, you know, if you really want this to be your, you know, your way of life, I really would say look for those agencies that are real, pure design agencies or creative agencies that are run, and the, whoever makes the stuff owns the company.
Yes, I think that's really good advice. Yeah.
Because, you know, the making of the stuff will be the thing that drives the decisions that run the company.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and you don't think about that when you, never thought about that when I joined. I was just grabbed whatever I could get. And I got lucky, but I could have equally also been in a real backwater of a place that was just about turning over the cash.
Yeah.
And a creative life doesn't need to be like that at all.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That sounds like very good advice.
Realize in the end, it's a profound privilege. It's a very powerful thing that you're doing, because everything you make is feeding the culture you're in. And what a wonderful thing to be, have an opportunity to do. No matter how small, we all have our forms of protest is too strong maybe, but forms of you affecting stuff, you know. It may seem that it's tiny and not having much effect, but actually collectively, it's all having a huge effect.
Yeah, massively.
And it's, so for, you know, every little choice you make about what you're making or supporting, realizing that is a brilliant thing. It's a fantastic thing.
Yeah, completely agree.
You have a voice. You have the possibility to make change.
Definitely. It's a very important thing to do. Thank you so much. Thanks, Harry, so
Absolute
much for coming
pleasure,
to the podcast.
Claire, I really enjoyed chatting.
Really enjoyed chatting to you.
Thanks a lot.